I've never heard that song before that we just sang prior to the lesson. The words are certainly fitting to go with the topic that we're going to be having this morning. However, I have to say that when I first saw the title of How Long Has It Been, I thought Stan was making some indication regarding the sermon length. When I lived in Vernon, we typically, as most congregations do, would have a song just right before you would get up to preach. And this one brother, one Lord's Day, picked the song Ready to Suffer just prior to my getting at home. This morning, while I sat in the hotel lobby eating breakfast over at the computer that they have in the lobby available for the guests to be able to use, there was a grown lady that came in, still in her two-piece, completely modest pajamas. And obviously, from looking at her, she had just crawled out of bed and couldn't wait to check her Facebook. And I just kind of sat there thinking about how embarrassed I would have been to been seen in public looking like that. And then it dawned on me how many mainstream, i.e. liberal, Churches of Christ that I have seen with signs saying, come as you are you in house coat and slippers? We don't care. Come as you are. And while we're certainly glad that everybody has come this morning, and sometimes we have to get off work or go to work and dress however is seen needful to be able to accomplish our day, it's really sad when some, such as those that would have a problem showing up in slippers and pajamas, come to stand before the throne of God without giving more thought or concern to it. This morning we want to talk about sin, suffering, and God. Everybody's got a different problem, but everybody's got problems. Not everybody's going to get cancer, but everybody's going to get a problem. It may be that it's a financial problem. It could be a health problem. It may be family problems. But the man without problems hasn't been born yet. Job talks about that in Job chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. And I don't know how we can possibly talk about suffering without bringing Job into it at some point. Job said, man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower and fades away. He flees like a shadow and does not continue. He uttered a great truth that there hasn't been an exception of that. Even in the case of Jesus, that was so, that man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. There's been a lot of arguments that people have tried to come up with against the existence of God throughout the years. Sometimes people will say, well, the Bible is false because, you know, the Old Testament talks about grapes in Egypt. And we know there's no grapes to grow in Egypt. And then they uncover tombs that show depictions of people carrying grapes. Or there's no such city as, or nation as, the Hittite nation. And then entire storehouses and school buildings and factories are uncovered bearing the name of Hittite. Time and time again, the Bible has shown itself to be true and man to be a liar. But one argument that has continued for thousands of years and continues to be repeated is the question of, well, if there is a loving God in heaven, why does he allow man to suffer? A man by the name of Epicurus who lived prior to Jesus. You've heard of the Epicurean philosophy of eat, drink, and be merry. And Paul makes reference to that in 1 Corinthians 15, by then adding the comment, for tomorrow we die. And Paul met with Epicureans on Mars Hill, along with Stoics, diametrically opposed groups. Epicurus, the founder of that group, that philosophy, had somewhat of a syllogism. He said, if you say there is an all-powerful, all-loving God, but sin and suffering exists, then either God is all-powerful, but he chooses not to use it to help us because suffering exists, therefore he's not all-good and all-loving. Or, if he is all-good and all-loving and can't do anything about our sin and suffering, then God is impotent and can't do anything, then the reverse of that would be that He could do something but chooses not to, so he's not all loving and all good. And so based on that, Epicurus decided that therefore there is no God. And unfortunately, some people in the world come to that conclusion today. You've heard, no doubt, people who, in the midst of calamities, will say, where was God when this happened? Where was God when my son was killed in Iraq? Where was God when my mother was laying in the nursing home suffering? Or you go to a nursing home and you visit with some of the elderly who are in pain, and often you will hear them say, why is God doing this to me? Or why is God letting this happen to me? Or we lose a loved one. These things cause us to have thought and ponder and consideration. Because once again, life is going to tumble into every one of our laps. And when it does, what then? Again, we all are going to have different problems, but we're all going to have some problem. And we're going to talk this evening, Lord willing, from Matthew chapter 4 and talking about a temptation that was prepared only for Jesus. These were temptations that would only work for him. The temptations of Matthew 4 would not work for you and I because we couldn't command stone to become bread. Only he could. But for each of us, there is also crafted a temptation. Now, I don't know if that means that the devil is setting wherever the devil sits, and he says, here's a temptation I'm going to craft specifically for Wayne. But because of the fact that there's so many arrows of the devil that are hurled my way, one of them is bound to land. It's going to be one that deals with me, with my situation. And I'll just make a personal example. Our oldest child, most of you are aware, or many of you are aware, completely fallen away from the Lord and went to life just complete utter rebellion against the Lord. And we withstood many trials and temptations through life, as Christians do. And when that came along, we were completely dejected. To the point that I seriously considered stopping preaching. If I can't keep my own child in the faith, how am I expected to help others? An older preacher counseled me. He said, Wayne, you're the one the devil's after. The devil's already got him. He's trying to use him to get to you. He said, don't let him win. And that was a good point. I took that to heart. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning, that there are these temptations that will come our way, that the devil seeks to deject us, that the devil seeks to discourage us and to fall away when these problems tumble in. And we're not necessarily talking about situations of gross immorality, but just daily problems. We're not talking about a brother or sister going off into adultery or a denomination. We're talking about just daily life's grinds that's going to be common to man that come to our life that sometimes makes us just give up and say, if this is what becomes of being a Christian, if God's not taking better care of me than this, then where is God? What's the need for God? What's the use for God? And those who have dealt with bereaved ones know that there is that set pattern that people go through. Psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors, preachers will tell you that when somebody is grieving, when somebody is bereaved, you start out with denial. No, that's not true. You're lying. And the next step is often after denial, is an anger. And it can be an anger at the one who left us behind saying, why did they do it? Why did they go off and leave us? Or, why did God let that happen? Sometimes the anger turns Godward. In Job chapter 2 and verse 9, Job's own wife said, you still hold fast your integrity, curse God and die. Job feels bad enough. He, just like her, has just lost family, possessions. And now his own wife is turning against him. You still hold fast your integrity, go ahead and curse God, and then die. He's being encouraged all the more even by own family to turn against God. We want to think this morning about some things that may help prepare us to be able to deal when life tumbles in. And be able to prepare us to be able to aid those who currently have life in their lap. If we're not aware of these things in advance of them, just hearing these things when they're in the midst of the problems doesn't always help, because these are mental knowledge issues that we're going to be expressing. And if you just tell somebody who's in the midst of grieving these facts, it may not always help. Because these are mental facts to a hard issue. But it will help when we know and take it to heart and advance them. And life will tumble into the laps of every one of us at some point, and on a semi-frequent basis, because that's the nature of life. Points, if you're trying to keep somewhat of a running outline in your mind, if you're trying to take notes, the problem of suffering. Point number one that we're going to try to deal with this is that the nature of suffering is the nature of human existence itself. Part of the nature of suffering is the nature of human existence itself. Newsflash, you're never promised a rose garden. We were never promised a life without suffering. We were never promised a life of constant happiness. That would be nice, but imagine if one was happy all the time. You wouldn't know that was happiness, would you? In other words, does a fish know it's in water? That's its only existence. It knows nothing else. To him, it's normal. If happiness were the norm, we wouldn't know what happiness was, because that would then become normal. It takes the valleys for us to be able to see the peaks. The Native Americans that lived in the Panhandle said that in the Panhandle, the mountains were underground. What they meant was you had to be in the canyons to be able to see the canyon walls, which to everybody else looks like the top flat ground around them. But if you go in the canyons, it looks like mountains. So the Native Americans said in the Panhandle, the mountains were underground. For you and I, happiness is to be found underground. When we look up and see what happiness is from when we were at the bottom. Otherwise, we wouldn't know what happiness was. The Bible even seems to assume that suffering is a part of human existence. That the Bible doesn't seek always to explain the way. The Bible doesn't seek always to give us an answer for it. But the Bible, as you simply read through it, you read about people having good times, you read about people having bad times, and it writes it from a historical standpoint as though it's just normal. And that is a normal part of human existence. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, and looking at verse 7, Paul talks about an aspect of life, saying that we brought nothing into this world, and certainly we cannot carry anything out of it either. In other words, we came into the world the way it was, and we're going to leave that same way. The world didn't change for you and I. God didn't set in heaven and say, you know what, Stan Cox is about to be born, so I'm going to change everything the way it is so he'll be happy. Stan isn't going to like cats, so I am going to get rid of all the cats in the world. That'd make two of us happy, actually, Stan, but make mice happy too. But you know what, there's a plan for it, and other people love them. So God isn't going to make other people unhappy in order to make Stan and Wayne happy. The fact is, we come into a world the way it already was. What's the state of the world as it already was when you and I were born? Well, it was a world that already had sin in it long before I got here, wasn't it? And because there was already sin in it, there was already murder, there's already stealing, there's already adultery, there's all of these gross immoral sins, and then a plethora of doctrinal sins, sins of omission that are going on all around long before I got here. And then suddenly I'm plugged into a world like that, a world that was already in existence, a world that was already fallen from the decay of sin. And I look around now and I'm in the midst of that, and I can't expect the world to change just because I'm here. So it's a nature of fact concerning life. It's the nature of human existence that I came to the world the way it was. Second, a lot of suffering is caused by ourselves and not God. Often, suffering can be caused by ourselves and not God. When God created all things in Genesis chapter 1, after each account of creation, what did God pronounce? Said it was good, didn't he? Seven times in Genesis chapter 1, and it was good. And finally in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 31, and all was very good. So it was perfect when it came from the hands of God. Was it God's fault then that things fell? Is to be blamed on God that things went astray when it left the hands of God? It's perfectly fine. You give something to your child and they bring it back to you and it's all apart and you look at it and say, Johnny, what'd you do? I didn't do it, Mommy. Well, it was fine when it left my hands and it was given into your hands. And now you give it back to me and it's all apart. Now you know you didn't do that, so somebody else was. And that's the way it is with God. When he created all things and said that it was good, indeed it was very good. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 9, the writer of Ecclesiastes tells us, whose fault responsibility the majority of these? And we're going to see some exceptions to it. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 29, the preacher says, truly this only have I found, that God made man upright, but they sought out many schemes. Man has brought so much upon themselves. When I was preaching in one congregation, we had a practice that they had an old, you remember the, well some of you might, an old box in the vestibule that some churches years ago used to drop money into the box in the vestibule if you want to go designate for certain things. And this was a leftover remnant of that. Well, they were no longer using it for that. But what it was being used for was questions to go into the box. And so once a month, I would take all the questions that had been put into that box, and one of our evening services, once a month, would be to take those questions, read the questions, give an answer from the Bible, and then on to the next question. One of the questions that was asked, and this will somewhat date it for you, was, why did John Wayne have to die? Now, the fellow who wrote it, and people did not sign their names to it, but the fellow who wrote it was the congregation comedian. He was the school teacher in the congregation, and as soon as I read that question without reading a name on it, every head in the audience turned around and looked at him. He really didn't think, he told me later, he said, I don't think you'd really read that. He said, I put it in there as a joke. And I said, no, there's a Bible answer to it. And the Bible answer would be found in Romans chapter 5. In Romans chapter 5, verse 12, I said, why did John Wayne have to die? I said, the answer is, Romans 5, 12, therefore, just as one man, through one man, sin entered the world, and death through sin, thus death spread to all men because all have sinned. That John Wayne died because sin came into the world. We die physically because of the sin of Adam and Eve. Now, we don't have to die spiritually. We die spiritually from our own sin. But we die physically as a repercussion of the sin in the Garden of Eden. God has appointed sin to bring death. And so when we say that sometimes suffering is a result of sin, that doesn't necessarily mean it's my own personal sin. It can be the sin of someone else. It can be the sin of someone a long time ago, as in the case of Adam and Eve, as we're presenting here. We can look at such incidents in Scripture and repercussions that came along with them, such as the flood. We talked about on Lord's Day morning the effect that the flood would have had on the earth. You've seen changes, I'm sure, made in your lifetime by water. Water is one of those powerful forces on the face of the earth. We underrate it. Entire towns, islands, swept away by water. Mariana's Trench, the pressure of water is so great you cannot even get robotic. You can't get robot scubas or subs down into that because of the weight of the water crushing in on it. When you consider that Mount Everest is 5.5 miles high, the amount of water taken to cover the tallest mountains on the earth in the flood, think of the great pressure that would have exerted upon the earth. Genesis tells us that the fountains of the deep burst forth, and so you can imagine the earth's crust being ripped open and the waters from inside the earth, the aquifers, bursting forth as well. So as you're driving along through the deserts and you see enormous plates of rock that at one time were laying horizontal that are now vertical, would have been a result of things, if not from that, or at least things like that. And so that the earth's topography would have been drastically changed. And so we have today such things as tornadoes, earthquakes, hurricanes. caused by changes in Earth's atmosphere, a change in topography, and so on. Once again, brought about as a result of sin, just not my personal sin. Next point to consider is, we can't expect God to save ourselves from ourselves. We can't expect God to save ourselves from ourselves. And this is tied on to a previous point. And that is that suffering is caused from sin, be it someone else's or my own. And then we mess our lives up. We get in a situation of a tangled divorce and remarriage, and we come running to the elders, we come running to the preacher and say, well, I cheated on my wife and she cheated on me first, and she did this and then I did that, and I'm remarried, and now her husband we really don't know about because he was in this situation, but I think I'm free because this or that, and now we have children in it, and we get into this tangled web that not sure that Solomon could completely unweave. And it gets difficult and sticky to deal with. But we take it one step at a time and say, okay, Matthew 19:9, one man, one woman, one exception. Does it fit this picture or not? If not, then we set this one aside, now let's go on to that next step. It's difficult to work through, but we expect there to be this instant answer, a quick answer, and most importantly for mankind, a non-painful answer to it. Because I want to be able to keep all of these things, even though I'm involved in all these sins that took to get through it. And then I expect God to save me from myself in spite of myself. And then guess what? When it doesn't work my way, it's, well, that preacher, those elders, that Bible, or why would God do this to me? When all I wanted was a happy home. Yeah, you committed adultery on your first wife, gave her a wrecked home, a terrible home, endless lost nights of sleep, children that now hate you, and now you're in this marriage. You say, but I just want a happy home. No, you had that. You blew it. Sorry. Here's the repercussion that you brought on, not only to yourself, but to that long lineage of children who now, unfortunately, may decide if not careful to walk in daddy's footsteps. Because of that example in the family. You'll notice if you look at statistics, families that have one case of divorce, that family will have multiple cases of divorces. Families that have one case of suicide will often have multiple cases of suicide. There is that influence that comes into the home. And then we get angry at God and say, well, I'm mad at God about this. And we're encouraged to think that way. Even though some insurance policies doesn't count in case of an act of God. Like God personally said in heaven, said, I'm going to drop a tornado on his house. Yeah. Acts of God. And we're taught to blame him then for various things, rather than saying, no, this is a result of sin somewhere along the line. Look to 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4. Peter writes to Christians who are being persecuted. In fact, he addresses the epistle in chapter 1 to pilgrims of the dispersion. Here were Christians that were being scattered, not because of any sins they had committed, but it's because of sins of others, wasn't it? Here were pagans that were saying, we're going to persecute Christians because they're not worshiping the emperor. And because of false allegations, because of gossip that there had been against Christians. My favorite book of the Bible to teach is the book of Revelation. In fact, I just finished a series in Louisiana of seven keys to unlock the book of Revelation. And I talk about the allegations that people made up against Christians in the first century because Christians were worshiping secretly because of government persecution. And when you do things secretly and in the dark that way, it's easy for them to concoct all sorts of stories about it. And some of the many stories that were being concocted against Christians, one of which was that people would just hear bits and pieces and snatches about what Christians believed. So they would hear something about a little baby, they would hear something about eating his blood and drinking his blood and eating his flesh. And so they wove that all together to say, you know, those Christians take little babies, roll them in dough and bake them and eat them. That was one of the gossips that was told about Christians in the first century when they had woven the little bits and snatches here and there together. And so the world, through all of this, of course, the government didn't discourage it since they were against Christians too. And so the world in the first century was turning against Christianity. Peter writes to encourage these Christians to continue living your life right before the world so that if and when they realize that you're a Christian and they hear bad things about Christians, they're going to know that's not true because of the manner of life you've already lived around them. And because of the fact that these Christians were suffering as a result of religious persecution, the gossip, the scandal that had been told about Christians, Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 15, "Let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, a busybody in other people's matters. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed." Now notice he points out two different ways of suffering. He says you can suffer in a way that you deserve to suffer. You can suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, a busybody in verse 15. That you bring that on yourself when you do those things. That when you suffer, that is, you're caught in murder and stealing, and you're punished by the state for that. Or you've heard the stories of somebody breaks another person's home and the homeowner shoots them and injures them or wounds them, and then that person will often turn around and sue the homeowner for having injured them in their house when they were the evildoer. A number of years ago, there was a case where a man broke into a house and he tried to flee out the glass patio window, not realizing that the glass was full too. And he went through it and cut himself up and he sued the homeowner and won. See, he was suffering as an evildoer. His cuts and pain was brought on by himself upon himself. And Peter warns us then, do not suffer, he says in verse 15, on things that you can bring on yourself. Here's a person that he has been a tobacco user, he's been an alcohol user, he has been an abuser of narcotics. And can he do away with those things and receive God's forgiveness? Most certainly. I know many fine Christians that you would never know are alcoholics. By that, I mean they are recovering alcoholics, but they will tell you they're alcoholics because you're an alcoholic for life. They've just been sober for 30, 40 years. But they have that alcoholic personality that they're struggling with every day. Their day, their struggle is probably greater in many respects than you and I could ever imagine. They're trying to get from work to home, from home to work each day, and pass every bar, every liquor store, every quick mart with having to say no, no, no the entire way. And they struggle with that, and they're faced with that. And they receive God's forgiveness and the forgiveness of the brethren, the forgiveness of their family. Does that guarantee they still will not die from cirrhosis of the liver? No. That's a physical repercussion that they have brought on themselves. The guilty fornicator in the case of divorce, the put away person, can they receive God's forgiveness and the forgiveness of brethren? Yes. Does that automatically mean that they have a right of remarriage or and go back to their first name? No. These are some repercussions, once again, that they brought on themselves. But people in both those cases will sometimes say, why is God doing this to me? I repented of this. Because this is a repercussion act that we brought on themselves. Now, keep going with me with Peter, though. After he points out that there are sins and suffering that we have brought on ourselves, rather as a result of sin, he then points out, though, that there's also suffering brought on us by sin, but now it's as a result of the sin of other people. Verse 16. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed. The suffering as a Christian, was it a result of sin? Yes, but whose sin? This time it was the sin of other people, not their own sins. But now their suffering was a result of the sin of other people. Now it's because of a pagan government. Now it's because of a greedy emperor. Now it's because of gossip of the communities. The people suffered as a result of sin. It just wasn't their sin. I went to college with a young man. If the word sweet could be used to describe a boy, I always tell my daughters, boys are nasty. Don't date boys. They're dirty.
including Cassie, but she didn't listen to me, Allison.
If sweet could be used to describe Roy, he was. He was a suite mate, not actually in my dorm, but in the adjacent suite. And he didn't know what he wanted to be. He was a member of the Lord's church. During Christmas vacation, he had decided he wanted to be a gospel preacher. During Christmas vacation, he was excited. He wrote and preached his first sermon. And he was driving back to college after New Year's to come back to school. After midnight, the dorm mother came running into her dorm and said, "Tim's been killed. A drunk driver doing 90 miles an hour in the wrong lane, never touched his brake, hit my friend head on. Both cars burst in flame." He was buried with his Bible and with that first sermon that was in the car with him. His mother at the funeral said, "Why did God do that to him?" You know what? God didn't have a thing in the world to do with that. A stupid drunk driver who rejected everything the Bible said. Who rejected the golden rule of do unto others. Who rejected the scriptures teaching and regarding sobriety and the use of alcohol. Who decided to take his life and other people's in his hands. Chose to reject all of God's law. Did that. You tell your child, "Don't touch that stove, it's hot." Are you to blame because he says, "I'm going to"? Does that? Well, maybe the baby's 6 months old. But when you got a 5-year-old or 10-year-old or 15-year-old who should know better and you tell them, "Don't do this, you're going to get hurt, and I'm going to do it anyway. Is it my fault now?" They've been warned, they've been told. Had this drunk driver listened, that wouldn't have happened. But we said in cases like that, sometimes say, "Why did God do it?" When God said everything to prevent it. Now we apply this to a lady who is suffering at home because she has a lousy, fornicating husband. And she may be sitting back too, saying, "Why did God let this happen?" And it may be that it was completely unforeseen. But it may also be that parents and members of the church went to that lady before she ever married and said, "You really need to think this one out. There's some problems with this couple." Or maybe there wasn't. But if your husband, that fornicator, had obeyed the teachings of Scripture, then there would be a happier home rather than a fornicator. So once again, it wasn't that God did this. If that person had done what the Scripture said, done what God told him to do, he wouldn't have. How could God give us free will and not give us the choice to obey it and not do it? To obey or disobey? He chose to disobey. And you chose to obey. So, once again, we're considering that the problem of suffering is a sin problem. But it's not a God problem. We look at such cases then, somebody says, "Alright, understand that preacher. Sin brought those things about." But what about you look on TV and you see, like, in areas throughout the world where there's so much starvation. You tell me those people are in sin and bringing on starvation? Let's think about where these places are, by and large. Where are some places of mass starvation? India. Here's dead bodies. And by the way, things are greatly improving in India. The past 10 years, they have had a cultural revolution over there. Their economy is just on fire in India. But there's also, you go from big cities where there's malls right next door, and here's villages with dung for their floors. And in such areas, there will be bodies laying dead on the side of the road from disease or starvation. And you say, well, there's an example of hunger and mass starvation, especially in northern India. How can that be a result of sin? Because here are dead bodies laying from starvation while there's a 1,000 Big Macs just walking past it. That is, here are cows that are being worshipped in a nation where there is mass starvation. Here are cows which God said to receive all food with thanksgiving. And yet they're rejecting. If, you know, sometimes you maybe you've had the experience, here's a nice dinner that's laid on the table, and one of your children says, "I don't like anything here. What is there to eat?" It's like, this is it. "Well, I don't like it." "Well, sorry, son. I'm not going to get up and let you get a peanut butter sandwich." "This is it." "Well, I'll go hungry then." "Okay, but you chose to do it." God has laid out 1,000 Big Macs walking up and down this street, and they're saying, "We're dying of starvation." It's like, "Hello, here it is. This is your choice." Or somebody says, "Okay, Ethiopia." And you might remember in the late 70s, early 80s, 79, 80 period, when churches, including Churches of Christ, were sending money to Ethiopia because there are several conservative faithful works in Ethiopia. In fact, a member of the church in Abilene, she is Ethiopian, has Ethiopian family, and they came here from their faithful church. Well, look at that, and somebody says, "Well, how's that a result of sin?" Well, what caused that famine? Did they just wake up one day and, "Oh, there's no food"? No. It's because of a communist takeover of the government. It's because of years of civil war and rioting. The men are all in battle or dead. Women were having to flee with their children from homes, so there was no land to call your own to plow the fields. There was no men around to be able to help. And so you've seen the pictures of the women trying to nurse their babies. There's nothing there to nurse because they themselves are this big around. And it's horrible pictures to see, but as a result of sin. Not their own, but the result of sin of this war and greed. And when food was sent to Ethiopia, guess where it went? It didn't go to those who needed it in the inner areas, which is often the case. It went to the communist rebels, the government, and those, so that once again greed ended up producing it. I was watching on TV last night that they were discussing, and I never heard of this one. They said that in Colombia, South America, a land of gold and oil and good land, so I would never dream this, they said that refugee villages in Ethiopia are rated as being the worst condition of anywhere in the world. Never heard of refugee villages in Ethiopia, much less they were in the worst. They said there are 4 million people living in refugee camps in Colombia. And this was because of the FARC rebels, the communist rebels coming in, driving them out, taking over the homes, taking over the land, and so on, and the government not being able to or not willing to help the people who were displaced by that. Once again, suffering, great amount of suffering. What's it caused by? Well, a communist. Okay, I understand that. But what's the real issue here? The real issue is sin, isn't it? Greed of running them off their land, the greed of wanting to take over the government, atheism and the communist government wanting to overthrow religion. So once again, sin has produced that on the world. Somebody says, okay, what about on 9/11? Here were people that were just peacefully going to work like usual. They had children they put in the daycare centers there, and the children, along with the adults, were massacred on 9/11. How is that a result of sin? That's an easy one to deal with. Once again, as a result of sin, not because of their own personal sins necessarily, although we do recognize Romans 3:23 that all have sinned fall short of the glory of God, but what caused that disaster was a sin. It was a sin of 19 pagans that we talked about last night. As a result of those who went against, violated the teaching of the New Testament. And at the risk of saying like a hobbyist, since we just talked about Islam for an hour and a half last night, we can't help but bring this into it again this morning. That when people tell you, and I'm sick of hearing the politically correct comment, that, well, Islam is a religion of peace. When Surah 2, verse 191 says, "Fight and kill, there is no persecution." And 3:152 says, "We shall strike terror into the hearts of those who disbelieve." Surah 4:9, seize and kill hypocrites wherever you find them. Surah 9:29, fight Jews and Christians until they become Muslims. That they adhere to that teaching and that book, therefore they adhere to sin, which brought about the pain and the agony and the disasters of 9/11. Once again, sin brought to fruition. Next. Suffering often comes as a result of living in a temporary world. Now, this is the exception. Sin comes as a result of living in a temporary world. I bought a Ford Granada back in the 70s, took it to a car wash, sprayed it with the high pressure, and stripped the paint. Just peels right off. And I was talking to my brother, who was a mechanic, about it, and he said, well, yeah. He said, those are built to last about 5 years. Why don't you put a 10-year paint job on a car that's going to be in the junkyard in 5 years? Our world is not intended to be permanent. This world is intended to last until God says it's going to. It's going to last until the Lord returns. And so the world is not intended to be permanent. You and I are not intended to be permanent inhabitants of this world either. You and I are like electronic products today. Our bodies are disposable and replaceable, but not repairable. Oh, they're repaired to a certain degree. You can re-sleeve an engine and do a number of things to an engine, but that reaches far. That old engine just wore out. And our bodies can be repaired, but that doesn't stop the aging process. Our bodies are not intended to last forever. When I hit about 35, I sat up in bed one morning and the sound came out of me. That came out of my father when he was older than I thought he was older than he ever really lived to be. And I'm going, wow, where'd that come from? And now I get up out of the chair after I sat there a while, and it kind of takes me just a minute but longer to start getting things moving again. Went to the chiropractor, which, as you get older, chiropractors are your friends. I've learned that. And I told the chiropractor, I said, you know what? I said, this stiffens up when I sit, and I get up, I just have to stand there just a second before I start moving. He said, yes, Wayne, that's called arthritic hip, and he said that's just kind of normal of a man your age. That's normal, you say. Our bodies are not intended to live forever. Now think about this. Suppose at age 100, you still felt like you did when you were 25. You're 100 years old and you know you're just biding your time to be called home, but yet you still feel like and think like and act like you did when you were 25. Would you be ready to go home? Probably not. Well, why don't I want to leave here? I still feel good. I still act good. I still want to do things. No, but you need to come home. Well, I don't want to, Lord. I still feel great. But the longer we live, the more we think about our home in heaven, don't we? We think less about the home on the earth because more things from our home are disappearing from us. Our loved ones, family members, friends have gone on before us. And we feel like we've got less to live for now than we used to. That's not a bad thought. We had a sister in Abilene who lived to be 101. Her mind was still sharp and it was intact, but her body was just wore out. And for the 10 years that I was in Abilene, she kept saying, has the Lord forgot to come get me? She said, I want to go home. She outlived 3 husbands. She said, I want to go home. And she just kept living. She finally asked, why isn't God getting me? Is God mad at me? Finally, her niece, because she had no children, which was another issue of why she was so ready to go. She said, well, Aunt Jill said, the Lord just getting your mansion ready. Don't worry about it. Let him take care of his part, and you just worry about your part. See, our bodies are not intended to last forever. And Paul talks about that to some degree in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Remember, man has put the chapter divisions in Scripture and not God. And although it's beneficial, sometimes it breaks up the thought in an improper place. And this is the case here. We're going to go from chapter 4 without missing a beat into chapter 5. As the Apostle says, starting in 4:16, therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing. Yet our inward man is being renewed day by day. If we could put this on a chart, I don't know if any of you remember a number of years ago, you know, brethren get caught up in all of these sales things that they go on every so often. Years ago after services, the Trump song over the parking lot, people would pull out, what was the products? Amway, thank you, Jeff. We'll pull out the Amway stuff and begin passing it all out the congregation. Then other members went into A.L. Williams Insurance. Wait, and it wasn't a banned product at all. And just a lot of members got involved in it, got caught up in it. And the way that A.L. Williams built their product, and they really did revolutionize the insurance company by the world, by the way. They said instead of paying for whole life insurance, buy term insurance. Buy collapsible insurance that goes away when you're 65 and you'll pay a fraction of the cost, but invest the rest of the money in stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and so on. And they would always have a chart saying the value of your insurance policy will keep going down until you're 65, but over here, you've got your investments that keep going up. So that by the time you're 65, you've got all this money in investments, even though you now have no insurance. But over here, you've got a lot of insurance and very little investments. And so, that chart kept moving like this. Paul says that's the way it is with our spiritual bodies versus our physical bodies. The outward man, he says, is perishing day by day, but the inward man is renewing day by day. That as we get older, we should be better spiritually, stronger spiritually, more mature spiritually. Even though our outward man now is less strong physically, is getting weaker as we get older rather than stronger. But our spiritual man should be getting stronger. So that by the time we're 70 or 80, we should be strong, mature Christians, even though our bodies may be getting weak and decayed. And we may have to have help physically, but we can be of strength to others spiritually. Think of those sisters who are 80, 90 years of age, and they're still out and able to get to the Lord's service, and they feel sometimes like, I'm not able to do anything for the Lord, but you are. You don't realize what a strength and encouragement you are to the rest of the saints. Because we get up with an aching toe or a child with a cold and we feel like, well, I just can't be there. And here's Brother Joe and Sister Sally who are 89, have arthritis, and they have to get up 3 hours before services to exercise and limber their legs and arms up enough to be able to get to the Lord's service. That's an encouragement to the rest of the saints. So our bodies are not intended to be permanent, as Paul points out in verse 16. We do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment. It doesn't always seem like a light affliction when you're in the midst of it, does it? When we hurt emotionally or physically. When we are receiving chemotherapy. When we have buried a loved one. That doesn't feel like a light affliction. But the apostle says, for our light affliction is but for a moment. Let's say it's for 20 years. Because the chances are we weren't born that way. So let's say that affliction that we have is the last 20 years. That's painful. And that's sad to have to suffer for that long. But in comparison to eternity, how long is that? That's why he's able to say our light affliction is but for a moment is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Why we do not look at the things which are seen, but the things that are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary. I look at my house is decaying, my car is decaying, my body is decaying. But he said the things that are seen are temporary. That's the way they're made. But the things that are not seen are eternal. For we know, and here's his conclusion from this, for we know that if our earthly house, our bodies, this tent, is a tent intended to be permanent dwelling, if you go out camping, you're in a tent, and you know it's temporary. And you can survive. You ever thought about, here are we guys, we go out into the woods, we'll go into a tent, we will put on thermal underwear, insulated socks, and we got our toboggans on and goose down coats, and we're sitting there and it's pouring down rain, and we're saying, oh, it's fun. You know, we love it. This is great. This is fun. And then we get back home and the thermostat's on 68, and the wife has prepared a meal, and we're saying, boy, it's too cold in here. We got to bump that up to 72. Honey, you undercooked that. You overcooked that. But boy, we sure endured a whole lot more in the tent. Thought that was just great. What's the difference? Well, aside from being unthankful and ungrateful, the difference is we knew that other was temporary. It was fun for a short while. Our bodies are temporary. And when we recognize that it's temporary, it helps us to endure that more. If I thought I had to stay in that tent in the rain and the cold, and that's the way I was going to live from here on in, that'd be a little different story. But you go out and do that for one night, two nights, say, oh, that's fine. But it makes you appreciate home more, doesn't it? You stay out any longer, you're going to start thinking about home. You're out there 3-4 days, you're going to be wanting to go home. We stay in this tent, the longer we stay in it, the more we start thinking about home. The more we start wanting to go home. And so the apostle points that out. We know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God. A house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven. If indeed having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. That verse 3 somehow scratched their head at, but the idea is, we're not just going to be invisible spirits in heaven. We're going to be clothed with another body. You've seen the cartoons we all have of spirits just floating around on clouds and playing harps, and Paul calls that being naked. We leave this body and we'll be clothed with another body. In verse 3, if indeed having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we are in this tent grown, being burdened. Not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed that mortality may be swallowed up by life. So we long to leave this tent. This tent is temporary. It's meant to be temporary. And it feels like it's temporary because it's meant to. Our next point. Don't worry, it's the last. Our next point is, a lot of suffering is actually for our benefit. A lot of suffering, if not intended for our benefit, is at least overturned and overruled for our benefit. When we ache and when we suffer and when we hurt and when we have problems, that should teach us to go to God. It teaches us humility. Look to 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Starting at verse 7. The apostle writes, lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Now he says that this thorn in the flesh was a messenger of the devil, yet he also says it's from God. when you look at the suffering of Job in Job chapter 1, the devil was permitted to do that to Job by God's permission in order to test Job. Paul uses a similar type of thought here. It's talked as though it's coming from the devil, but then also as though it's from the Lord. The Lord is allowing this to happen to Paul and will overturn it for a good use. In verse 8, concerning these things, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I'll rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and needs and persecutions and distress for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. As a younger preacher, sometimes we are guilty of making what sounds like good arguments on things that may actually be arguing on behalf of what's truth. But then we learn later that really wasn't a very good argument, though, to support it. And one that I've made and heard others make it too is in regards to the faith healers today, the so-called faith healers. That you had people like Oral Roberts, whose own son died. And decades ago when that happened, I pointed out, you know, if he was really a faith healer, then why didn't he heal his son? And then years later, I got thinking, you know, that really wasn't a good argument. Because here's the Apostle Paul who, and don't get me wrong, I don't believe in Oral Roberts, don't believe in modern day miracles of faith healing, just that's a bad argument to try to assert it. But here was Paul, an apostle, who laid hands on other people and healed them, and yet he himself could not be healed. But what was the purpose of miracles according to Hebrews chapter 2, verses 1 through 3? The purpose of miracles was to confirm the word. Paul already believed, didn't he? Paul's already a Christian. Could the Lord have allowed him to recover from this? Well, yes. But instead the Lord chose to allow him to keep this infirmity because it produced a powerful, positive result in his life. The apostle says in verse 9, the Lord said, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. Paul's conclusion then was, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. You've heard that saying that what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And then I like the other side of that, what doesn't kill me? Better run real fast. There's a lot of truth to that. What doesn't kill us makes us strong. It makes us humble. It teaches us to go to the Lord. It teaches us where to go in the midst of trials. What did James say about is any suffering? James talks about singing when we're happy, calling for the elders when we're ill, and praying when we're in the midst of problems. James 5:13, is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing psalms. Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church. But if any is suffering, let him pray. If we don't learn to pray in the midnight hour, we're not going to learn to pray in the sunshine. That's a simple fact. Going back again to the book of Job, Jesus spoke about the patience of Job. And recently a friend of mine on Facebook made a comment. She said, I wish I had the patience of Job. And I said, well, I'll go through the trials of Job in your mind. And she said, I don't know if I want it that bad. We talk about the patience of Job, but Job did begin to lose his patience. Now, that still doesn't mean that he was impatient. Who would have had after all that? But it got to the point in the life of Job where he began saying such as, if I were in a court of law and I would demand God come down here and I would demand to know why he's doing me this way, I would plead my case, I'd plead my innocence, and I would demand of him an answer to why this is going on in my life. And then after Job makes a series of such statements, God in a whirlwind speaks to Job in Job chapter 38 and begins giving a series of rhetorical questions to, quote, put Job in his place. Saying, Job, where were you when I created the earth? Job, how did I do this? If you're so smart, how about telling me, Job? And after Job has been humbled by the Lord, and the amazing thing is, in all of that, do you find any place where God explained to Job why these things happened? You and I know what happened in the case of Job because we read it in retrospect, in hindsight. As far as we can tell, Job never was told why these things happened to him. The only thing that God did with Job in starting in chapter 38 and going through 42 was to tell Job, you just need to get in your place, trust me, and know that I am God. And that was it. Case closed. Question settled. And Job then expressed in Job chapter 42 in the first 6 verses, Job answered the Lord and said, I know you can do everything. No purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I've uttered what I did not understand. Things that are too wonderful for me, which I didn't know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Job says, never mind, Lord. I recognize that you are all powerful. I realize that what you do is for the best of me and it's because you love me, and I will accept that without knowing any more than that. Job expresses that even if God were to explain the whys to him, that it'd be too powerful and wonderful for him to even understand. And is willing to accept God's decisions on all things. In Revelation chapter 21 and verse 4, Revelation 21 and verse 4, there's this passage of encouragement to these Christians who are being slain and tortured and persecuted. Not because of their sins, but because of the sins of others, the persecutors and pagans. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Life tumbles in and will land in the lap of every one of us at some point, at some time or another. The question is, what will we do with that life when it tumbles in? Can we help you this morning in responding to the Lord's invitation? We encourage you, pray with you. Even though this has not been an evangelistic lesson, we don't want to leave without offering an opportunity to respond to an invitation if you have a need. If you need the prayers and encouragement of the congregation, if we can immerse you into your Lord. If there are public sins, you wish an opportunity to publicly repent of. And we want to give you such an opportunity. If you'll come at this time, as we stand together and sing the song that's been selected.